I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The acclaimed writer Chris Cleave joins me again. He has just published a new novel, Everyone Brave is Forgiven. The notices have been terrific already, and it's being hailed as one of his finest works. His previous three novels have also been critically acclaimed and bestsellers. In this book, just as the Second World War begins, Mary enlists to do her part. Tom Shaw doesn't, while his roommate Alistair does. I'll get Mr. Cleave to tell us about these characters, what sort of war it is for them, and the genesis of this story. Chris Cleave's previous books include Incendiary, which was published in 20 countries and won the 2006 Somerset Maugham Award, and was shortlisted for the 2006 Commonwealth Writers Prize. His most recent book was Gold, and he was first on this program when Little B, his New York Times bestseller, was published in 2009. He lives in London but joins me from here in Vancouver last week while in town for appearances, including one with the Vancouver Writers' Fest. His website is at chriscleave.com. This new book is published by Bond Street Books. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, Chris Cleave. Mr. Cleave, good morning.
Good morning. Hello. Great to talk to you again.
The same. I'm enjoying this book a great deal. But for people listening to us who haven't picked it up yet, and we'd like them to because it's such a good story. There's some great characters and some marvelous lines in this book. As the book opens, we meet Mary, and she goes to the War Office to enlist. I guess the war has just been, declared on Germany. What sort of background does she have as she goes to enlist?
So Mary is from a very privileged background. Her father's a member of parliament in London, and her mother is a society person whose main aim in life is to ease her husband's path to power. And that's the background that Mary grows up in.
And is she encouraged to join the war effort? Or?
She decides that her family are probably going to ask her not to sit it out.
Yeah.
And so, really in defiance of them, she decides to enlist, to volunteer for the war effort as soon as it's declared. She puts her name forward to volunteer for war work the moment war is declared. And she's assigned to become a school teacher, which is not what she'd expected at all. And she expects that she'll be sent off to do something very dashing and glamorous,
mm-hmm.
and in fact she's given this job which at first to her seems very mundane, which is to teach children. And as the book develops, this actually becomes really important to her. She understands the value of it, and in teaching some children who are very marginalized in society, she ends up teaching children who aren't evacuated from London at the outbreak of war. Because they are from less favoured minorities, and they are people with mental health issues that weren't well understood at the time.
Yeah.
Her deciding to do this puts her at odds with her family's principles, and so she ends up in a kind of rebellion against her family, which is, if you like, a battle within the war. So she has two conflicts that she has to win.
Yeah, we've heard of the evacuation of children and others during the war. I mean, the numbers are, I mean, it's in the millions, isn't it, of people who were evacuated to the countryside, say?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Around 3 million people were evacuated. They were young people, children,
yeah.
Some of their carers, and some vulnerable adults who were taken out of London as soon as war was declared. To places where they would be safer.
And then the kids that Mary teaches are the ones who don't, and you see right away, I guess, and they're not sent to the countryside because I guess they wouldn't be welcome there.
Yeah, the evacuation wasn't compulsory, so 80% of families took up the government's offer to have their children rehomed with strangers for the duration. 20% didn't take them up on that offer, and within that 20%, I found that ethnic minorities were disproportionately represented, and I think the reason is because those families didn't really trust the majority population to look after them properly. And so we join Mary when she is teaching these children who are, you know, less favored by society.
And you shine a light in this book as to the racism of the era, because it is it's not. I guess it's not something that we would know, those of us who are outside of Britain, and certainly who didn't live in that era.
Yeah, it's something that's, I think, been quite conveniently forgotten. I think there's a tendency for societies to invent a more glamorous myth of their own past, a more heroic version. Now, I don't dispute at all the narrative that the Allies, you know, Britain, America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, were a heroic generation, and that they did, you know, collectively save the world. I'm not disputing that for a minute. I don't either dispute that Churchillian narrative that period was, you know, was our finest hour.
Mm-hmm.
However, I do think it's interesting to examine what society was like in detail. I think it's important to acknowledge how hard it was for people who weren't comfortably part of the mainstream of society to be treated fairly, because that's actually another battle that we had to win, and I think that was won during the war and after. And I think it was important to give an honest portrayal of what life would have been like in London. Mm-hmm. I think if you're not going to really go into the detail and make a very realistic portrait of what London was like in the Blitz, then there isn't anything else new to say about it,
mm-hmm.
Other than to do something that's very accurate and hasn't been done before.
So, Mary, how does she encounter Tom and Alistair? I guess they're roommates, as we'd say in this country, flatmates.
That's right.
And what sort of war is it for Tom and Alistair?
Well, Tom and Alistair come from a slightly lower-born circumstance than Mary's. So they are sort of more ordinary, what in the UK I guess we would call middle-class families.
Mm-hmm.
And Alistair is an art restorer. He works at the Tate Gallery in London, fixing up canvases and their frames. And Tom is an administrator in an education authority. And at the beginning of the war, both of them think that they might not get involved in it. Tom definitely decides he will sit the war out. Alistair is a bit more ambivalent about it, not really sure where he fits into that effort. And eventually, Tom and Alistair find themselves on different sides of that decision. Alistair decides that he will sign up. He decides that whatever he can do for his country is probably more important than continuing to curate an art gallery which has actually been cleared out. They evacuated the paintings at the same time as they evacuated the children. They evacuated everything that was precious. Whereas Alistair's flatmate, Tom, decides at the beginning of the book that he won't join the war effort. Later on, in fact, he tries to, but because he is in what's called an exempted profession, that is administering teaching, he's not even allowed to join up, and that actually causes him a lot of trauma.
And so the connection with Mary is born how?
So Mary falls in love with Tom,
mm-hmm.
Who she meets through her work in education. And that picture is a little complicated later on when she meets Tom's flatmate, Alistair.
Because I've read about the I've read reviews and I've read articles about you and this book in preparing for our chat today. These characters, Mary and Alistair especially, are based on people that you knew.
Yeah, that's right. Mary and Alistair are based in terms of their characters on my maternal grandparents. So my grandmother was a teacher and she taught in and around London during the war. And my grandfather was stationed in Malta during the war, during that great siege of the island, as a captain in the Royal Artillery. And so my route into writing this book was familial. I had a memoir that my grandfather had written that I typed up for him. And that was my route. That was the beginning of a really immersive journey for me into trying to find out more about who my grandparents were, and to try and find out how their minds worked and how their friends' minds worked during the war. And the book is a meditation on the nature of courage, really.
Yeah.
And so I was interested not in whether people were brave or not at the time, because I think that's undisputed. What I was interested in was how they made themselves brave, you know, what it was that made that generation so extraordinary, and to see if we could potentially do that again now.
Yeah, a lot of us who aren't English look to the English, look to Britons, you know, and we think of the Second World War as shaping the character of how we consider Britain, you know, all that stiff upper lip stuff, keep calm and carry on, Churchill. I mean, and that seems shaped by the war experience. So in the course of your research and in writing this book, do you have a sense of where that comes from?
Yeah, I have. I think it comes from two places. So I think in terms of that short-term courage to face immediate and terrifying threats with a certain degree of courage, I think so much of that came from the habit that people had at the time of conversation. I think people talked through their fear. I think they made each other laugh more than we give them credit for, certainly in the war novels and war movies that I grew up with. I think they were complex and funny people who dealt with their fear by making each other laugh. And so I think in the novel, humor is really the mainstay of how they communicate verbally. And I think that made them courageous. I think when you go over the top, when you go into battle, I think, yes, you do it for orders. Yes, you do it out of a sense of duty. But more than that, you do that for your friends. And you do it for your friends because you know that they will do it for you. And you know that that's the case because you've spent such a long time bonding with them. So I think when the characters in the novel are messing around and joking and laughing, you know, I don't think they're wasting their time. I think they're actually winning the war. So my first answer is that courage, the courage to act in a crisis, came a lot from the habit they had of communicating in a loving and humorous way with each other. My second answer is that the courage for the long-term endurance that was necessary to get through the war came from their habit of expressing themselves in letters. Mm. So many of the people I talked with and investigated had a core of strength to them that came from a person they loved. Often those relationships were maintained at long distance through letters, into which people poured all of themselves. They put their whole character into letters, and it gave people something to fall in love with. You know, they communicated in a way that I think we're losing the habit of, and I think having those very strong relationships with people gave long-term anchors to people, gave them a reason to endure the misery of rations, the trauma of bombing, and the long-term psychological effects of battle.
So how do we get back to that? I mean, technology seems to connect us. It's saying that it's connecting us in more ways than before, but it's also isolating us a great deal.
Yeah, I buy that completely, what you say. I think we now have this very high frequency but low intensity mode of communicating with each other that tends to encourage us to project a surface rather than a personality. You know, we project the illusion of happiness at each other rather than talking about who we really are as unique people. Certainly when I look at my own children's experience, you know, at school they're actively told not to pour too much of their deepest emotions into letters to their friends and to people they care about, because, you know, when it all goes wrong, these things have a habit of ending up splurged all over the internet.
Mm.
I think that's a problem, actually. I think it's a shame that we've lost from our society the habit of really expressing ourselves as people in private to other people that we care about. I think that is something that gave people of that era a lot of faith in each other and a lot of understanding of how different people were one from another. I think there's a homogenization that's come with the kind of communication that we have now.
You talk in the book, obviously, of the war experience, what it was like at home and abroad. You mentioned a moment ago, you alluded to the misery of rations, and I understand that you put yourself through that as well.
Yes, but only for 3 months. So I put that in the context that the people who fought the war had to get through on rations for years. People on the home front in the UK, for example, were on rations all through the war and for several years afterwards too. So I felt it was important to research the book as deeply as I could. And it was certainly, when I went onto rations, it was a real eye-opener because it's so demotivating. It makes you feeble in the mind and in the body, and made it all the more remarkable that that generation were able to work through that and to fight through that, despite the lack of things like fresh fruit, vitamins, the lack of nutrition actually depletes you faster than I had imagined. So it was good. I managed to cope with it for 3 months. I mean, there were people on the home front who had to do that for 8 or 10 years.
Did it change how you thought about yourself? I mean, I know it gives you the experience of what these people went through, but going forward, did it change your life in that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's on two levels, I think. One is that it showed me where I came from as a person. By going back into my own family for the first time as a novelist, I began to understand a little bit more about how it all fits together and how we all came to be. I think writing about the Second World War is interesting because it's not just my family, it's everyone's family. We have all come through that, and that's made us very strong. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that it's helped me to draw on some of the techniques that the wartime generation had for looking at life differently. They did a couple of things that I think we can do today to our benefit. One was that they lived every day with phenomenal intensity because they didn't know where the next day was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is they learned the difference between a frustration and a real problem. I now look at my own problems and I relativize them. For example, I have a frustration that I can never get through to the end of my inbox. But now I think, it's not shrapnel, It's just email. It's not going to kill me. And I think the more I exposed myself to narratives of that generation, the more it gave me a kind of clarity about how we live now.
Yeah, people have said of your previous books how prescient they were, because they were set in times that were close to when they were published. This book obviously is not set in the present day, but it does teach us a lot about ourselves and what we could do.
Yeah, I certainly think there's a sense in which every novel that anyone ever writes is about the time that they're living in and the time that they're writing in. I certainly learned a lot about how we live now by thinking about how they lived then.
Mm.
I think a novel is a way of taking 3 steps back from life so that you have enough perspective to look at it from a different viewpoint. And that's all I've tried to do with all of my novels. They're about how we live, and they're hopefully an entertaining examination of how we live. Because
yeah.
I've never felt that reading ought to be a punishment. I want to take people on this immersive journey into these marginal worlds that give us perspective on how we live.
What do you know about bravery that you didn't know before writing this book?
I know that it means a different thing to every single person. So what's brave to one person will be completely different to the next. Stepping into a hail of bullets is second nature for some people. They have no fear in the conventional sense, whereas they might find it extremely difficult to share something about their feelings to someone they love. That might be a braver thing for them. Mm. You know, I've realised that courage is something you grow like a muscle, and that the more you use it, the more it begins to work for you. And that's why I think that wartime generation were so extraordinary. Not because they were different from us, but because they were exactly the same as us. You know, we're genetically the same as those people. What they had that we didn't have was an enormous test of their courage and their endurance. And it was through being tested that they grew courageous and strong. And so I think in the same way that our society is starting to have a growth model of intelligence, you know, we no longer believe that you're born smart or whatever. We believe mm-hmm. that you can work on that. Well, actually, I think it's the same with courage. And, you know, it's something that you develop as you are tested and as you dare to test yourself a bit more. And the reason I think that's important is because I think we live in a time where it's important that people take a moral stand on the issues that face the world we live in now. You know, we are at a crisis of capitalism. We are in a crisis with the movement of people around the world. We are in a time of deep political divisions in our society. It's never been more important for people to step up and be brave. And I guess what I've learned about courage through looking at that wartime generation is that they weren't brave to start with either. It was something that they learned, and it's something that we can all build.
Do you wonder what your grandparents would have thought of this book?
Yes, I did. I was lucky enough to have my maternal grandfather still alive while I was working on the book, and I spoke with him about it, and he knew that I was working on it. But he died during the writing process, and so I would have loved to know what he had thought about it. I like to think that the funny bits would have made him laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that he would have been pleased with the emphasis in the book on the way people communicated and the way they spoke and how that made them brave.
Mm.
You know, I think he'd have been pleased that I didn't go to places that I feel I have no right to talk about. You know, I don't talk about battle at all. I don't think as a novelist you can write about that if you haven't been involved. But I do think there's a kind of clarity with which you can write about conversation and communication and the things that people did in between the fighting. I think they'd have been pleased with the way I wrote the book. Whether they would have enjoyed it, I couldn't say, but I really hope they would have.
Yeah. So the notices for this book have been quite good, and a lot of critics are saying that it's your best work. Does it feel like that for you?
Every book that I write is the result of me turning myself inside out to try to do the best I can. So they all feel to me as if I've asked a question about the way we live that's a relevant question, that I've done as much research as anyone could do, and that I've tried really hard to make it an immersive experience for the reader into a place that they wouldn't necessarily go otherwise. And so I don't really compare my novels one to the other. I just, my satisfaction is thinking, yeah, I've done the best job I could on that.
Well, it's a moving book, and I can't wait to finish it, Chris. Thanks for this, and continued good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been great talking with you again. Thank you.
The same. The book is called Everyone Brave is Forgiven. Bond Street Books is its publisher. Its author, Chris Cleave, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.